desert.
And the great American Southwest. I bid you good evening, good morning, good afternoon in all of Earth's time zones. Worldwide coverage, and the program is called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. It's great to be here. In a moment, we're going to hear from the amazing Kreskin. Now, he has asked for 5 minutes of airtime. So that's what we're going to give him. And it's going to be interesting to see what he has to say. I assume, now I don't know what he's going to say, so I assume it's going to have something to do with his prediction, but maybe not. He says, quote, I'm convinced that in May or June of this year, we are at May, right, the largest sighting to date, that's UFO sighting, will take place in the Nevada desert. Probably, he says, the largest sighting in the past century. And he is so convinced of the accuracy of that prediction that he's put up $50,000 to an as-yet-unnamed charity if it does not happen. So in a moment, for whatever reason, we're going to have the amazing Kreskin. He's got an announcement, and I'm every bit as curious as you. Friday night, Saturday morning. In a second, Kreskin. In the next hour, Ed Dames. First item up on the agenda is the Levy case. Chandra Levy. So we'll ask him about that, of course, and then we will move on from there. But any night that has Major Dames included in it is going to be a wild night of talk radio. That would be this night, believe me. Let's now see what the man who's got $50,000 out on the hook, virtually suggesting, saying that a gigantic UFO, perhaps largest ever sighted in the century, will or perhaps may appear above my very head. Here from, I think, the Silverton in Las Vegas, where he's performing as Kreskin. Hey, Kreskin.
Or how are you? And my regards to you from a writer who I guess is going to be with you tomorrow, Danian Brinkley, who was came to the show.
Danian Brinkley, yes.
I've got to, and I appreciate the time because you're an important guest, and sometime in the future I'd like to share with you my comments on the Levy case because this goes back to when it first broke, but that's a whole other story.
Okay.
The reason I'm calling you is, first of all, the thousands of people who called my office and everywhere else, I owe this to you. I can't talk to all of you folks. I understand how you feel and the tremendous curiosity and the interest and so forth. So I made a decision because I cannot address 3,000 some calls. You have to understand this. And this is what I decided to do. First of all,
so we generated a few calls for you.
You sure have calls from Ireland. I will go on and on.
Yes, yes.
But I owe this. I owe this out of all integrity. First of all, since I'm going to, I'm going to announce nationally in the Associated Press is going to attend on Monday, the day that this incident will happen, and it will happen next week. I'm going to announce the approximate time of the day it will take place.
All right.
However, there's concern with the police and everybody else of masses. I don't want to go in, but because documentary cues are coming in as well as press and everything else, I think what I have to do is this. We've thought this out. I'm going to just hold a meeting, not a show. No one is to come here. Please, folks, do not come here expecting a show. The Silverton here in Las Vegas is going to set aside a gigantic room. Those who want to attend the event as a group, because we don't want chaos on the desert. I've been on the desert at night. I have visions.
You don't worry about my listeners. They can handle this.
No, but at the same time, people can't be running about with press to interview them and understand, what has happened and so on. So I'm going to have a meeting at 7:30 Monday here. And those who are really serious, I will explain to them exactly where we pick the site where people can gather with relative safety. I mean, these places are not lit.
So you're going to nail it right down to the exact time, the day and time.
I'm going to nail it in the morning here in Las Vegas.
Is this going to be a daytime or nighttime sign?
It's going to be nighttime. That's the concern. It's going to be nighttime.
Ah.
It's going to be late. It's going to be late, Art. That's the concern. And I just don't want, listen, I'm excited, but
damn it, it is going to be in my show, isn't it?
Art, and I will talk to you. I will talk to you that evening, and because I'm going to give directions. But people should come here at 7:30.
So you're not prepared to give it up right now?
No, but I think I should offer a number just in case there's confusion, because I can't, if it's all right with you, I just offer a number where people can at least call and get some directions. They can come here, and I, by the way, they should not expect a show. I just
All right, we got that down. All right, so what is your number?
It's at the Silverton, 702-263-7777. It's 263-7777. Yep. I can't speak to anyone. They will courteously explain the time and Art, it will happen next week. And Monday, I will give...
Hold it. Let me be clear about this. You're giving out this number, and you're saying people can call it and find out when.
Where they can meet... Meet here. I'm not going to give out the location. They're going to meet here. I want a serious group of people. This is too serious.
Okay. Do you stick by your original prediction regarding the magnitude of the event, the biggest UFO sighting, et cetera?
The near biggest, and the amount, again, and I please no more astronomers calling me. I'm not talking about shooting stars, Art. I'm not talking about shooting stars. I'm talking about three or four, most four. That's all. No more.
Craft.
Right, that's it.
All right.
And I appreciate the time, Art, very, very much.
Oh, happy to give it to you.
It's gotten, thanks to you very much. The interest is beyond anything, but I want to say something, and Art, we will talk when this is all over. There's a lot more to this that I've even hinted at, and I think it'll be clear when it's all over.
Well, to name the day and the time, Kreskin, I got to say, that takes amazing cojones. You take care, and we'll see you soon.
Take care, and Godspeed. I'll talk to you in a few days.
All right. Take care. Amazing cojones indeed. So there's going to be a meeting, and then there's going to be, I guess, a gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's kind of interesting. You got to admit, it takes cojones to nail it right down. Well, the news is filled with all kinds of terrible things. Big collapse at a park in Pittsburgh. 20 to 50 injured, one dead on a ride called the Whip. I've had one really bad experience at a park. Nothing like that. Not a, a collapse. Oh, my God. But that's, I think you all would agree. Isn't that what goes through your mind? I don't care when, what ride you're getting on. And a lot of them are really scary. I mean, like you go right out over the edge. It feels like you're tipping over. All kinds of things. So, the thought of a collapse has always been in my mind. Just like when you get on an airplane. Now, there's always at least a second or two whether you wonder whether your plane is going to get to the other place it's going safely, right? Just human nature. These things occur to you. I wonder if I'm going to get to see... I bet this thing is going to occur during my show. I'll bet you. He said late. He said at night. The odds are now going up incredibly that it's going to occur right during my show. Now, what will I do? Let's see. Will I have warning? Yes. Perhaps a fast blast. Will these objects be here long? I don't know. But sounds like Kreskin is bound and determined to have a lot of people watching when something happens or doesn't. Really sticking his neck out. All right, well, the big news, of course, is India and Pakistan and... it looks pretty serious. Now they have suggested... that, I mean, there's like 60,000 Americans in India, and they've suggested that the Americans, and other nationalities, I might add, get the hell out of the region. In other words, it's only at this point a suggestion. Basically, they're saying, we're suggesting that Americans... should consider this serious enough to pick up sticks and go home. Now, I wonder what will happen. I suspect that you got to fly on your own nickel. Later, if it gets more serious, then, of course, U.S. government would probably say, you are now ordered home. Report to following military aircraft. We're evacuating all Americans. When that happens, then I think you all want to, with open eyes, understand that probably nuclear war is imminent. How much can you believe of what you read in the press right now? It's going all over the place, you know, talking about the evacuation. And Defense Secretary warned that war between the Asian rivals would be, and here's a quote, somewhere between terrible and catastrophic. And that's kind of what I thought last night. Actually, if you recall the program last night, I kind of said that it was between what my guest was suggesting it might be and what my caller was suggesting it might be. Somewhere between terrible and catastrophic sounds about right. So if you hear of mandatory evacuations, if you start hearing about that, then I think we're pretty close to something really happening. In a situation, fluid war-like situation of this sort, the first thing that suffers is reporting. You know, the reporting gets really lousy, so whatever it is we're reading here is probably pretty meaningless. It could be either racing toward nuclear conflict, or it could all be some sort of overblown thing that's not going to happen. There's just no way to know, but the signs are not too good. Indeed, they're not too good. Now, let's see. I've got a few things on the website for you. Well, I've got a moment to mention them. With regard to Harvey Wasserman last night, you know, he talked about the Davis-Bessey reactor photos, and you remember the almost 6 inches of shielding this stuff went through. We've been provided some close-up photographs by Scott Porcelain of exactly what we're talking about. That's under What's New right now, along with a number of other things. The Sci-Fi Channel in New York City ran this video, and I haven't had it before with audio. I haven't seen it with audio. It is, without question, one of the more startling UFO videos you're ever going to see, ever. You know, this is the one where a UFO comes out from behind a building, and the photograph or the video is being, and this is a very good copy of the video, is being taken inside a helicopter, I believe. And here comes this UFO out from behind a building, and then, like that, it is gone to the horizon, that fast. And it's gone to the horizon. You can see a smoke trail behind it in this curve that no conventional aircraft could ever make. It's an astounding piece of video. And then somebody, one of you out there, sent me a video of a B-2 bomber, which I thought was very well captured indeed. The B-2, if you know, for a lot of people in this country who had not seen a B-2, if you saw a B-2 bomber, you go take a look at this video during the day, as clearly as this was seen, you would think you were seeing an alien aircraft. I mean, no question about it. You would think you were seeing an alien aircraft. It is an amazing aircraft. It's a pretty good video this fellow took. And then we've got, under the category of what in the world is this, I'd say right on, what in the world or out of it, what is this? Whether it was from a museum or, you know, wherever the picture was taken, I mean, it looks like it was taken, I guess, at the beach, huh? And this picture is of what appears to be clearly a half man, stick with me here, half man, half alligator. I don't know what to tell you about that. You're going to want to take a look at this. It's all at artbell.com, and the way you progress through looking at these various things is to go to the top of the page under What's New. And there are some pretty scary photographs of, can you imagine that? This stuff, 3/8 of an inch of this, reactor. And, it would have opened up, the gates of hell on earth, in all likelihood. That's getting pretty close. Pretty close indeed. And then there's this war thing. You know, a nuclear exchange between these two powers could kill, it said, up to 12 million people, injure 7 million. Between 9 and 12 million actually would die, and another 2 to 7 million would be injured. That's incomprehensible, I think, to almost everybody. That's a cataclysm. That's the world's... would that be the world's biggest cataclysm? 9 to 12 million people. I think more people than that died of the flu. But the consequences, of course, of this, of nuclear war, even if it was held to these two countries, it would make areas uninhabitable for a long, long time. True insanity. True insanity, in my opinion. And all over Kashmir, and is it not sometimes interesting to consider that these rats, you know, these rats that attacked us are, for the most part, said to be now in Kashmir. And here's sort of a general something for you. It comes by email from Dan. Sometimes, when you think about what's on the news, don't you feel a little bit like Bruce Willis in that movie? I occasionally look around at friends, co-workers, family, beautiful buildings, cars, supermarkets are overflowing with cheap, plentiful food. Everyone's relatively clean, fed, healthy. I can't help but think to myself, this could all be gone in an instant. And according to the evening news, it looks like it'll be damn soon, if not a nuclear holocaust courtesy of India and Pakistan, then bioterrorism or maybe global warming or maybe genetic engineering. The list goes on and on. There are as many plausible end-of-the-world scenarios floating around right now as there are flavors at Starbucks. Sometimes I'm afraid to put your show on because I don't want to hear the latest explanation on how the human race is going to have its collective posterior handed to it on a platter. But then you also talk about cool stuff like water or life on Mars. So I keep listening. Now, you might not always like what you hear on the show, on your show, but one thing for sure, it's interesting. Anyway, just thought I'd put in my current sleep, put my good current sleep deprivation to use, throw in my 2 cents. Thanks for helping me stay awake as well. And he goes on to say, it was a crummy night shift job, but my show gets him through the night. It's great, Dan. I share that view with you to some degree. Now, we are always talking, of course, on this program about events that are way out on the edge. At least that's the way it once was. Now, to some degree, the world has caught up with me. So the mainstream topics are pretty much the things that we talked about for years. You know, things that were said, you may recall, search your memories, everybody, that for years we had guests on who said that the kind of thing that we're having right now would indeed come to pass. And these things are now coming to pass, aren't they? We have a threat of bioterrorism. I mean, somebody could let something loose. Captain trips all the way, right? And it begins going around the world. That's one little scenario. Another is a full nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan. You know, 100, 150 dirty bombs going off. It's almost incomprehensible. But that is the world we're living in today. They knock down buildings, hit the Pentagon, try to put a plane into the White House. It is a different world. We talked about it years ago. Well, all right, into an open line segment. Anything you want to talk about is absolutely fair game. On the first time caller line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm doing. Get close to that phone and yell at us. You're not too loud, so you're going to
have to. I'm not too loud.
You're going to have to yell at us. So where are you?
I have to turn. I'm in Winnipeg.
Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Yes, way up north.
Canada.
Uh-huh.
You don't like that very much, do you?
No, I love Canada.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah. I've spent quite a bit of time in Canada, actually.
When?
Oh, gosh, many times. I've been to Vancouver several times. I've driven the Alcan Highway up to Alaska through Canada and some pretty wild country three times. And I took the Canadian National Railroad from Vancouver over to the Falls. So I'd say I've done a fair amount of traveling there.
Yeah? I just want to phone in and say that I'm getting a certain amount of shaking going on here.
What kind of shaking?
Every time that from my, I get this thing, the bottom of my spine right up to the top of my head, it starts shaking.
And that means?
That something is going to happen. Big time.
Yeah, it has the feel of it, all right.
I heard you guys talk about the out-of-body type of thing. I never went out. Maybe I did. I don't know, but I get this really weird shaking going on here. Not to sound like the song, but...
So you think something... So anyway, you think something's coming?
Yeah. And,
well,
join
the crowd.
Wait a minute, though.
Yep.
You're not
going to
hang up on me, are you?
I don't know. Depends on what you say.
You have Kreskin on, right?
I had Kreskin on.
Yeah,
a few
you had
minutes
him on.
Ago. Yeah. Now he's
going to
name. Now he's
going to
name the date and the time.
Yeah, well, what day did he say? Like four
he
days
didn't.
Now?
No, he didn't say. He
said four, right?
Well, no.
No, yes, he did.
No, he said that he was going to have. There was a number to call to find out when the meeting was going to be.
The other time you had him on, you said that.
Oh, you're talking about the number of craft.
You would have him on when he felt something coming.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he did. He came on when he said he's now discerned the date and the time this is going to happen. So it's appropriate that he come back, and that's even though he didn't give us a date and time, which he could have. He obviously wants to have a meeting to announce this. But, you know, all things considered, you still got to say it's a pretty cojone-filled prediction, especially when you get down to naming the date and the time, even though he didn't name it here. You know, pretty close in. I mean, probably now closer than the end of June, because originally it was either in May or June, right? So it's now almost June. The timeline is closing in, but to name the exact date and time, Wild Card Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
Yes, Robert from Los Angeles out of Preskin. This thing is talking about a prediction.
Yes.
As you all know that when UFOs are seen in abundance, it's usually when us humans are going crazy at war. So he may be stating that there's going to be an attack. I believe that's what he's talking about, some sort of attack going to happen. The UFOs come in. If you know the Foo Fighters are in World War II, there's UFOs everywhere.
Well, there are, sir, a group of people in this country and indeed around the world who think that at the very last moment, as the missiles fly and the nuclear warheads are just about to detonate, they will swoop down and save our asses. Sir, I am not one of those people.
You know what? I think I told a friend, I said, once we launch on each other, all the UFOs are going to leave. They can say, enough of these people. They're just crazy.
Well, either that or they're going to regard us as immediate available real estate.
Dinner, probably. And anyway, that it's pretty neat. He's a performer, so I was thinking, well, maybe he probably slipped some Russians some money and said, okay, gimbal your solar reflectors up there on some satellites and give these guys a show. Yeah, you know what I mean?
But you see, that would cost more than $50,000. Of course.
Yeah. But if you know Russians and science and stuff, you know, it just is a joke. You know, so I said, okay, yeah, let's just do that as a joke. But, you know, Russians are pretty loose people. But, anyway, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, as you know, with this crisis. India and Pakistan. So I don't know. Maybe that could escalate because, you know, the saying when the cats away the mice will play. Mm. If India and Pakistan get into anything, guess what? Iraq, you know, they have something. And when we're trying to, you know, cause something from happening down there, our backs going to be turned and Iraq will pull a slip, slip a fast one and hit Israel with something. I just heard on the news, I hope callers could call in. They heard this. I heard part of it. They said Iraq would just received a missile casing from Russia or China, just one of them. And they have it. They have something valuable they want to put on that. It's a very expensive rocket, and I believe that's probably a game for Israel. And I'd like to hear that again on the news, because they said that they're trying to. They found the box that it came in with the satellite sitting it there, and then when we came to investigate it, they burnt it to cover up their tracks. But I really am scared that something's going to happen in this world. I don't see why everybody's going crazy right now. I mean, everything's fine. So, I mean, our country is fine. We live a decent life. I don't see there isn't any major droughts or any reasons for people to be trying to kill each other.
And yet, here it is, though.
Yeah, it's weird. Like you said, it's quickening. I hate to admit it. When I heard you talk about it years ago, I go, oh, I don't get it. But I'm starting to get it. Things seem like it's almost like a movie we've seen before. It's rerunning again.
I know.
You know, and it's like deja vu all over again. It seems like this already happened. And
or is predestined, and we know it. I don't know which. It could be either one, right?
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, we came so far. I mean, look at our technology. I mean, we're doing so well technology-wise. We're going to be able to visit, you know, the Mars pretty soon. I've been reading about NASA and their anti-gravity programs that they're working in
Ohio.
The
way it's going right now, sir, as I said to Richard last night, we'd better go to Mars pretty soon because, you know, there may not be a here.
Right.
Maybe it's the grand cycle. You see, maybe we originally came from Mars to Earth because Mars got flattened.
Right.
And now maybe the cycle continues and we go back to Mars. And, you know, while they're sitting up there on Mars, they start to see these mushrooms blooming.
Ping pong, yeah, back and forth. It's really sad. I mean, I like technology, how you know, it advances. And it's a lot of fun for me because I'm into radio like you, and computers are a blast.
Oh,
and
yeah.
If you blow all this up, God, we're going to be back in the dirt again. I mean, who knows how many times this has happened throughout history. You know, we the pyramids were built. We still don't know how they did that, and they were wiped out somehow. It's just there's no evidence of how they put these things together. And we're finding pyramids at the bottom of the ocean, all sorts of artifacts, and we don't know what happened at that point, if it was a natural event that flooded the world and wiped out people and we start over and over again. But we just have to, you know, progress forward and try to be at a point where we could protect ourselves from ourselves, and we're not at that point yet. We can't protect the whole world yet, and it's just ready all to go hell in a handbasket, and there's nothing we could do about it. That's what's so scary about it.
Yeah, we're just observers. Very interesting point, sir. That's all we can be here, I guess, right now, particularly in this situation, is observers. Now, I've asked for, but I don't know that I've received, in fact, last night's guest, Greenpeace guy, right, said that it would be absolutely catastrophic, you know, that the amount of radiation that would get into the jet stream and be deposited around the world. I would like some realistic estimates by somebody who really knows. If there were to be a full exchange between India and Pakistan, and assuming they were mostly ground bursts, knowing the rough megatonnage, a scientist could certainly, it seems to me, do some pretty good projections, not only on how many would die, they've certainly done that in the immediate area, but on what would be lifted into the upper atmosphere, the jet stream, and then deposited right on our doorstep. I would think that would be one critical thing we would want to know right now, and I haven't heard anybody yet with a really good estimate of what would happen. Maybe they just don't know. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
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 It's Bob in Houston.
Bob in Houston. Okay.
Yes. I know that a few times you've used the power of your audience to assist seriously ill people.
It's happened, yes.
I wondered if you'd ever given any thought to using the power of your audience to try to get a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians.
Well, I guess if you were going to use it right now, sir, you'd be wanting to work on the India-Pakistan problem. That seems more urgent, perhaps. But here's the thing, and let me explain this again to everybody. This is a really serious power, and you may be shaking your head or laughing or something, but if you've been a listener through the experiments that we have done, numbering now more than two hands full of fingers, the successful, incredible, unbelievable experiments,
and yet absolutely documented, because we did each one on the air here, painstakingly, over a period now of actually years. And one thing that I resigned myself to was that I wasn't going to tamper with large forces, you know. In fact, since I don't know a doggone thing about this power, except that it appears to be real, people wanted me to turn hurricanes, you know, and avoid this and avoid that. And certainly, I can understand a lot of people would say, for God's sakes, avoid nuclear war, use it that way. But not understanding the power, you really have to imagine that the law of unintended consequences, I hate even uttering that sentence on this program, could be operative, and you could end up causing something with regard to those two countries that would be just the worst scenario you can imagine. I'm not saying that would happen, and I'm not saying it wouldn't. I'm saying I don't think I would want to be director of an effort of that magnitude right now. I just don't know enough about this power. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Newbreed here.
Yes, sir.
Good to hear you back.
Thank you.
I just want to say something about the geological record. There's a lot of things that we do know. And I love your program, by the way. And I haven't actually read your book, The Coming Global Superstorm, but...
You'll catch the movie soon.
Right on. But there's some pretty interesting data points. I'm not sure if they're in there, amongst which having to do with the 90,000 years of cold and 10,000 years of warm cycles that just repeat over and over again. They're basically tied to the trees. The trees all over the world are dying because, as a matter of fact, the minerals that they live on are ground up during the ice ages, and then after about 10 years, they're all depleted, so they're all dying right now. And when they die, for example, an acre of trees produces 50 tons of carbon dioxide. After about 10,000 years, the minerals are gone, and the carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere, and that basically decreases the temperature levels at the poles. So, you know, you have coastal areas being flooded and so on and so forth.
So you're saying it's a sort of a biological cycle, really.
Yeah.
Right?
But, I mean, it really doesn't have anything to do with us, which I'd be glad to say if it did, you know. But
well,
it's just,
you know,
part
what?
Of the...
We don't know, though. Because we haven't been around with an industrial world to ever move through one of those cycles that you just talked about. So you can't possibly know what our effect would be on it.
But, I mean, the cycle happens irregardless of us.
I understand that, sir. But with regard to whether we have any part in, say, bringing it on earlier or delaying it or anything else, we have no idea what the effect of modern civilization is on this cycle or any cycle. That chapter has not yet been written. We're writing that one right now. On the first time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how you doing, Art?
I'm doing okay. Turn your radio off, please.
It is.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
My name is Bill. I'm listening to you on the 550 AM, St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes, sir. KTRS.
Yes, it is. It's a powerhouse.
It is.
Also the home of George Norrie.
Indeed.
I'm calling you in regards to, Pakistan and India.
Yes.
I really think what we've got is two biggest bullies on the block in that area, and eventually they're going to fight. I just think we ought to go in and wipe out both the governments and say, okay, now both of these belong to the United States. You're going to do what you're told or be eliminated.
You mean take their countries?
Yes. If they're just like kids with toys. If you don't know how to play with them right, you take them away.
Well, I don't know what we're going to do about the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
We get it in Afghanistan.
It's not just China and India. You know, we've got to start thinking about Iraq real hard, because they're making poisons to kill us, bugs to kill us, and nuclear weapons to kill us fast as they can.
Also, you talk about on your show about these underground, underwater cities and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I dabble a little bit with psychic powers, and my belief that we're in the 217th cycle of life on this planet, as far as human life, And we're not done yet. I think we're going to end up having to go through another cycle or two before we get it right.
Do you think there's a constant voice from above that's probably by now, if all that's true, getting tired of saying, and let there be some more light?
No, I think God's one of those that's just going to, he's going to keep going until he gets things right. I think he's a perfectionist.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Wild card line, not a lot of time here. You're on the air if you'll turn your radio off.
Art?
Yes.
I've been wanting to call you ever since you started talking about those ear candles.
Oh, yes.
When I was a teenager, my mom was into all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And we found out that those ear candles are kind of fakes because you can take one and hold your fingertip under the end of it and burn it, and you'll still get the same amount of wax inside it.
You know, I didn't. A million people told me what you're telling me, and so I tried it. And there were certainly some leavens in it, but not the same as when I originally ear candled. Nowhere close.
Okay.
I went out and did all those measurements, believe me. Just like people said to do.
Okay. Well, I've just been wanting to bring that up to you ever since you mentioned it.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you. East of the Rockies, you might have a little time. Hello.
Hi, Art. First time caller. Wondering about whether or not Major Ed Dames has been contacted with respect to Chandra Levy's issue. His prediction that...
Wait, whoa. Major Dames is coming on in like 10 minutes.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, good.
Oh, you didn't listen, huh?
Well, I've been in and out. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Want to know whether or not he has anything to say about the discovery of her body and his prediction, which was sort of different.
Well, when it was first discovered, I said, hey, look at this. Major Dames is flat wrong.
Right.
But then the chief of police there started talking about, well, how did the body get here?
And
he suggested himself the possibility that the body had been moved, you know, because they just couldn't have missed it that many times going over it with dogs that look for human remains. It just isn't probable that they missed it.
But later they suggested that it was moved. It was not moved.
Well, I guess
in later reports they said it was in the area.
They're suggesting, yeah, but sir, that park was combed and combed and combed and combed with dogs that recognize human bodies, and they didn't find it.
Well, but they alleged they didn't go that as far as the dog that found it.
Well.
But it's interesting to know what Major Dames would say.
Well, interestingly, sir, you're about to find out.
Great, thanks very much.
See you later. Well, with world news in mind, coming up in a moment is one of the most beloved and hated people on the program, Major Ed Dames. And that's the truth, the most beloved and the most hated. People just rage against this man on the one hand, but on the other hand, when you schedule him for Wednesday and he doesn't appear, you get thousands and thousands of phone calls saying, where the hell is he? Fancy he's on tonight. So that's what I say when I say one of the most hated and beloved, or maybe I should at least give him the benefit of the doubt and say beloved and hated people on the planet. The world's foremost remote viewing teacher, Major Ed Dames. U.S. Army retired, is the creator of technical remote viewing and the director of the Technical Remote Viewing Institute, an original member of the U.S. Army Remote Viewing Training Program. He subsequently served as the training and operations officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency's Psychic Intelligence Collection Unit. And he currently serves as executive director for the Matrix Intelligence Agency, a private consulting group. Now, I can tell you this much. Many years ago, the bar of belief for me was passed by remote viewing. I absolutely believe remote viewing is real. I have done probably 100 hours of interviewing, maybe 200, of the various remote viewers that have been in the program, including the biggest, best, and brightest. And without a doubt, Major Ed Dames is the most controversial of the group. He is exactly what he says he is. I can tell you that much as well. I mean, I've got a copy of his military record. I've read his military record. So he is exactly what he says he is. Now, he says things that tend to scare the hell out of people. I should tell you that up front. They tend to really scare the hell out of people, and so I think that's where the hate part comes. People, some people don't like to be scared. Other people, for some reason, like it. So we're going to cover, as you can imagine, a lot of wild topics tonight. We'll begin with the Chandra Levy thing in a moment. Well, the stock market delivers unto you many, many days of rotten news. And then you have a day like today, Friday, when it gives you like, what was it? How many points? It was like less than 10, wasn't it? And not much movement in the NASDAQ either. They're really low, both of them. And I wonder what next week is going to bring. World tension is as it has never been before, obviously, at the moment. We're suggesting that Americans living in the area skedaddle and get out of Dodge and come home because there might be a nuclear war. That's called world tension, big time. And the markets are not performing very well now. Gold, on the other hand, has, I told you, and it's all of history, so it's not much to say, but I did tell you, and I am correct, that gold is rising very quickly right now. And even in normal times, it makes sense to have a hedge for your market investments. Now it probably makes more sense than ever right now. Right this very minute. Have the people at my sponsor, Lear Financial, send you information in all likelihood you will not get from your broker. It's Lear's audio seminar entitled, Why the Experts Pick Gold in 2002, worth $29 and free to you. Just for the asking, call and say you heard it here on Art Bell. 1-800-474-4259. 1-800-474-4259. Now, how would you like to feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks? Well, that's impossible. You can't know what it's like to feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks because it's never happened to you. Would you like that? After that, the promise of human growth hormone, ultimate HGH actually, is that the physical, measurable, documentable physical changes will begin to occur in you. Let's say cholesterol levels, for example, that you can measure. The increase in muscle mass, 8.8% on average, 14.4% of loss of fat. But then other things, more energy, diminished wrinkling of the skin, your immune function is better. Everything's better. Memory, vision, all the things you associate with youth begin to get better. That's what it does. And if you want to buy it from Great American Products, we'll include a $20 value book so you can read about what's happening to you. The number is 1-800-557-4627 if you'd like to try. It's about $33 a month. That compares extremely favorably to about $100 a month for other competitors. 1-800-557-4627. All right. The most beloved and the most hated. We'll use the beloved word first. Here from the islands out there in the Pacific is Major Ed Dames. That is where you are, right?
I'm here for a few more days and then off to Washington, D.C. on the Chandra Levy case.
On the Chandra Levy case.
Yes, I'm hand carrying our data art to Washington, D.C.
Okay, so you obviously have new data then, correct?
Yeah, we had to resume this case. First of all, how are you?
I'm fine. What I want to do, Ed, is let's first go back. I mean, you did say she was tossed in the Potomac or would be found in the Potomac. I think you said near bridge is what I recall. Is that roughly accurate?
That's roughly accurate. That was a bad analytical call on my case. I'll tell you how that happened in a minute. You remember, you were the one that asked us to do this, that asked my institute to do this. And,
oh, yes.
And that's what the only reason why we took it on. The only public service work that we do is on missing and exploited children. So we broke away. That's Project GoldenEye. The Technical Remote Viewing Institute has a project called Operation GoldenEye, and it's looking for missing abducted children who are on the National Center for Missing.
Yeah, I'm aware you do that, but you did. You took it on anyway.
We took it on, and Fast and Furious, and that, the project was interrupted by 9/11. We quickly shifted our focus to whoever funded the attack on the World Trade Center, and we passed that to Special Operations Command. But we didn't resume the Levy case. Now, when we left off, as I mentioned before on your show, for a professional remote viewer, it takes less than an hour, far less than an hour to determine if someone is dead or alive.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy to do in our work.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew immediately as a team that she was dead.
Yeah, you said that.
When we take on a job like this, it's do we go for the body or do first, or do we go for the killer or the killers first? Which one do we do? And in this case, we thought that we could help the D.C. Police Department, Chief Ramsey.
You mean with regard to the location of the body, right?
Yeah, yes.
Once you've got corpus lecti there, once you've got the corpse, then you can either go for the location or for the person who committed the crime.
Correct. Once we understand that a person is dead and we know that we're dealing with a body instead of a living person,
okay.
Then if we're sticking with the case, then we have to make a decision. Do we put our effort and our focus on to locating the body or locating the killer or killers?
Uh-huh.
Which one do we do?
Okay.
And in this particular case, Shonda Levy, you know, we felt that providing the D.C. police information on the killer, I'll go into that in detail in a moment, would be better than providing information on the body because it takes us so long to locate a body. I'll have more to say about that with regard to our on the ground in Oregon in a week after next.
Okay, but are you saying that with regard to the location of her body, now there's some interesting circumstances, I'm sure you're well aware, with regard to how in heaven's name they could have missed her body going over that park again and again and again with dogs that were designed to look for human remains, you know, and they can detect a dead human body very, very easily. When they searched, they didn't find her there many times. Now, that's suspicious to the point where the Washington, D.C. police chief suggested one possibility would be that the body was moved.
We're not sure. The data that I had from my team and myself indicated that her body was in the Potomac.
I gotcha.
Actually, in the Potomac. Now, we speculated at the time that we might be dealing with a serial killer, and it's speculation. It's not data. That this person may have done this before and may have previously killed a young woman and put her body in the Potomac.
I'm certainly aware that the police have as one open option the possibility of serial killer in this case.
Yeah. Well, what we're concerned with now is nailing the killer. So all of our focus is on identifying the killer.
So then you're declaring, you're just saying it was a miss.
Yes, I'm saying it was a miss.
Okay. Yeah. You could
it's
have
like the military art. You know, when the general comes to you and says, if you're the intelligence officer and the general says to you, Dames, which way is the enemy coming? You don't say, well, they could be coming this way, or they might flank us from the west, or they might do this or that. You know, you put your hand on the map and you say, this way.
Yeah.
The other hand's behind you with fingers crossed, but you better darn well, you know, you got to commit. And so that's not a critical thing for me.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I give you credit for that, because you could have come on here and very easily talked about the police chief and the fact that the body might have been moved, and you still might be right, but instead you're just declaring it a miss. That's all right.
Yeah, it's just a miss.
All right, cool.
But we're not going to miss on the killer. And I'm promising you that right now. You know, that's a promise. We're not going to miss on the killer. I'm going to Washington, D.C. personally. I'm flying out on Tuesday to make sure that we don't miss. We know the killer works in a restaurant in either Georgetown or D.C. All that we have to do right now is identify the particular restaurant that he works in. Actually, it's kind of a bar or a lounge. It's not a restaurant. And it's just a matter of a few more days before we nail the restaurant. And then it's a matter of sitting down with the D.C. police and saying, that's the person right over there. So that's why I'm going to D.C., to pull a recon to match up our sketches of the restaurant with the candidates that we've already identified.
Okay, well, I don't know who you go to in D.C., Ed, but... there must be somebody pretty high up in intelligence or police or whatever. And how do they take you when you know, if you march off to Washington, D.C. and you deliver remote-viewed evidence to the police?
The next week, and then it's a more difficult problem. But here's the thing, Art. If our description, our remote viewer's description of the killer, and we have a Top Gun team on this, if that matches one of the people that Chief Ramsey and his crew interviewed, then we're cooking. And, you know, it's time for some unconventional things anyway, whether it's terrorism or murder. We know we can do this. And yes, I do have contacts in D.C. That is my old stomping ground. We face, in Oregon, we're looking for, there's three children. Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis disappeared close to each other in time earlier this year in Oregon City. There, we have fingered who we believe to be the murderer, and I cannot talk about that on the air.
That's true.
And then down in Tri-City, we've been looking for another missing child who we say was murdered. We've been looking for her body for quite a while. We have all the remote viewing data we can possibly get. So I have I'm leading a four-man Sandman team. These are top guns. They're all, except for one, instructor-level remote viewers, and they know what they're doing. We can remote viewer right on site. We don't have to sit back in an office somewhere if we need extra information. We'll be working with the police in two towns up there, and actually to pinpoint, in one case, a murderer, who we say is a murderer who killed two girls, and we're walking the police onto the site where we're saying the murderer placed the bodies. By the way, we're also going to stop in and make a courtesy visit to Premier Networks with Alan Corbin, spend a little bit of time with him.
That's
and your
Alan
crew.
Corbett, yes.
Your crew up there in Medford.
Well, good. You should certainly enjoy that. How much difference or degree of difficulty is there between locating a dead body and a living person?
Oh, the bodies are terribly difficult.
Why?
For instance, if we were involved, and we are not, it's all of our work is public service, and in the China Levy case, it's public interest, because our public service work is only missing and exploited and endangered children. That's it.
Okay, why is it so much harder?
Because most of the time, we're dealing with a body that is in a homogeneous terrain. Killers usually put the body somewhere in water, swamp, desert, somewhere where it's off the beaten path, far from the madding crowd, and there are very few terrain features that allow us to get a grasp on where we are. Now, if we were in the bounty hunting business, and let's say we go to America's Most Wanted and we take a photo of a criminal, that's a cakewalk. That is a cakewalk, because it takes us just a little while to pinpoint the general location of someone. And then we can send a team on the ground, armed or not, and we have that. We have a bounty hunting team that we can work with. Send them on the ground, and they can go to the place. Let's say, for instance, in the Chandra Levy case, we were looking for a criminal who has whose face is on a wanted poster. We send the team to a restaurant. It's a simple matter of walking in and holding the wanted poster up to see if anybody in that place looks like that. In the case of John DeLevy's murderer, we're going to have to sketch the face and make sure we've got the right restaurant, and then we don't have 100% proof. We've got to get the police next to us and point out who we're saying is the killer and hope that they have interviewed this person before, or something like that.
If we assume that Chandra Levy's body was and has always been exactly where they found it, there in the park. How would you get a mist that would show the Potomac in a bridge and water, as opposed to greenery and solid earth and park?
I think my guess, Art, is that the killer, we were working pretty fast. We were working really fast, and I was throwing a lot at my team too fast. I'm going to have to take the hit on this. It's not my team members. It's a bad call, analytical call in my case. However, I have to say we did get the Potomac River, which leads me to suspect that this guy has, this person, and is a man, a young man, did put somebody else in the river. And the collective unconscious may have latched on for some reason.
I see.
For some reason. This is speculation on my part.
Yeah, and they're speculating back there now to some degree that it could be a serial killer, that there were some other, I guess, similar M.O.s. Then the family came out and said, we really wish you wouldn't talk about a suspect. We actually have one, and, you know, it's been an interesting ride, to be sure. But that's how it could happen. In other words, the same man, for example, could have killed at a prior time and put the body in the Potomac.
Well, that hasn't happened before in our work. That's why I'm saying it. You know, it appears to be a fluke. I have not run into this particular problem in my work. Usually when we specify an individual, in this case we're trying to leave his present location, and we're getting the water, the actual Potomac River, then that's where she's at. And in this case she was not there, which in my work is a fluke. So I'm going to have to suggest that it was probably something that I did, and I'd have to go back in, and I think that I was throwing targets at my team too fast. I was looking at both the killer and the body.
Uh-huh.
And we do have information on how she died also, but I'm going to save that for when I sit down with the D.C. police.
So then locating a specific body or a dead body of a person doesn't require, there has to be no soul left in there. If there is a soul, there has to be no ongoing brain activity. None of that is important. You can find a dead body as easily as you can find a gas canister in Iraq.
In the same manner. It's never easy. In fact, it's very, very difficult many times. We have to, for instance, on these, let's go for one of the children that we're after in Tri-City, Oregon. It took a long time and a lot of detailed work, remote viewing before. We're now able to go up there, you know, with a team and compare our sketches with the actual location and say, okay, let's dig here. But it took a long time to do that because we have to now look for the most nearby, the most recognizable terrain features. We have to look for significant man-made features that are around, because killers usually stick a body far off the beaten path. And in this case, we know exactly what kind of an old barn we're looking for. We know what kind of how far away from the barn she is, and those kind of things. It takes a lot of work, Art. A lot of work.
Well, you constantly surprise me, Ed.
Well, we want to make sure we're successful on this. Well, like I say, we're on the ground this time. It's not just remote viewing. It's a Sandman team on the ground. It's a reconnaissance on the ground in Washington, D.C. The remote viewing's over. It's time to go down with our work and point or dig. And we've got at least we have proof positive or affirmation from Oregon City that, yes, the person that we say is the murderer is indeed one of the people that they are looking at.
All right, Ed, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is very interesting. I mean, Ed could have easily, because of all the talk that's going on in D.C. right now, just said, well, the body was in the Potomac and was moved, or a million other things, because they just really don't know, and it seems so impossible they didn't find the body. But no, he's just saying straight out, it was a miss. Every time I expect something of Ed, it seems like I get the exact opposite. It's really interesting. We're going to ask, incidentally, about India and Pakistan and the ongoing tensions in a moment. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast. again, Major Dames. Major Dames, welcome back. All right, listen, I don't know if you can do anything to alleviate fears or enhance them, but of course the world is kind of hanging right now on this Pakistan India situation. It's pretty damn serious. I mean, they're recommending Americans leave the area. Probably at minimum 60,000, they said, in India. I mean, that's pretty serious. Now they got to go on their own nickel, take an airliner. So it's not like the military jets are waiting. We're taking Americans away ourselves yet. But it's pretty worrisome what's going on over there. You have any words for all this?
I do. I do have some words. I think they'd be more comforting than Dr. Dumish, actually. In 1991, I worked at the Office of Secretary of Defense Level and Intelligence. I worked the nuclear non-proliferation problem. And I was watching India very carefully, so I know a lot about the India's nuclear program.
Okay.
And I want to provide a scenario to you. And I listened to your guest last night and to the callers and yourself. Excellent program, by the way.
Okay, so what we're about to hear then is your understanding, not by remote viewing, but your understanding of what's going on.
That's correct. I'm going to lean on my both my expertise and my background as a military intelligence officer that was involved in nuclear non-proliferation. I'm going to provide a scenario to you, which is hypothetical. Okay?
Sure.
Let's call it hypothetical.
All right.
All right. Do you think that America would allow a nuclear slugfest between those two countries? Art, do you believe that we would allow that?
Well, you know, I certainly don't think we want it. However, you would have to be the one to tell me how we would stop it.
I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation.
All right.
All that money that your tax dollars have spent on some very black programs.
Yes.
The reason that some of the most expensive of those black programs were developed, including the stuff that comes in and out of Area 51.
Yes.
That's our nation's Sunday punch. And it was developed for not exactly this kind of a situation, but for the following. So that anybody who didn't like us anywhere in the world, who had an ICBM,
yep,
that ICBM could be stopped before it reached America. Because once a missile goes ballistic, that is, you know, there's a boost phase for an ICBM.
Correct.
It goes up, and then the engine shuts off, the earth turns underneath it, and it comes down just like a rock.
That's right, yes.
Okay. It's very hard, very, very difficult, as you might know, to stop warheads from after they're slung out from a bus, a reentry vehicle, to stop the warheads.
Well, once they're starting to reenter, then almost,
you got a big problem.
Forget it, yeah.
Very, very extremely difficult. That's why your laser platforms were developed and those kinds of things, battlefield
okay.
lasers. All right. So what we had to develop, okay, again, I'm talking hypothetically, is something that could stop a missile on the boost phase or while it's still in the launcher, right?
Well, that was what Star Wars was, part of what it was all about.
Part. But Star Wars was a long time ago. And, albeit, it takes a long time for technology to mature. So Star Wars is just now maturing, but actually some of the original concepts there, the technology's changed and evolved. But let me continue with my hypothesis.
By all means.
We're going to have to choose sides on this one. India and Pakistan both want to be the superpower in South Asia. There can only be one, right? And it's going to be India. So what I think would happen is the following. We have deep space platforms and other intelligence gathering systems that can see a missile being readied in a silo.
I believe that, yes.
Yes, oh, it very easy. Or a missile being transported on a TEL, a transporter erector launcher.
Yeah,
you know, those things that you pull behind you and they
yep.
crank up like little kids' toys that they
sure.
stand straight up.
I believe all that,
fuel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What we would do, and I'm sure that Rumsfeld has either approached the Indian government, the Pakistani government with the following, I think that he probably has, following along this hypothesis, is that we will tell the Indians and possibly the Pakistanis that there will be no war because this is what we're going to do. We're going to take out every Pakistani missile before it gets off the ground. With the weapons that American tax dollars have, so much American tax dollars have spent to do just that, but for different scenarios. One, a rogue government or splinter groups or Russia or China, but this time in an unexpected scenario, because we're not going to allow that slugfest to happen. Obviously, the level of insanity, if that did happen, is terrible. So what we would do, we would choose sides. India would be the winner by default. They will be the superpower. To be a superpower, you need nuclear weapons, right? There can only be one superpower in South Asia. India has coveted that role. The badge of a superpower is nuclear weapons.
And then to India would go Kashmir by default?
Not necessarily. We're not eliminating in this scenario, this hypothetical scenario, conventional weapons, just nuclear weapons.
Right.
India would be very happy that now Pakistan has lost all its. You know, if this is a chessboard, you just lost your queen.
Well, yeah, I understand, but
that's what I'm saying, Art, is that this is just weird. Just not going to allow
Flat out, Ed, how sure are you we actually have that capability?
Just a hypothesis, Art. But I will tell you, you live close to a really interesting place. Things come and go out of that area a lot. At Mach 17, Mach 20, that's pretty fast. That's enough to be... You know, that's bad out of hell fast. That's enough to be someplace really quick. Enough so that if you see something being fueled on the other side of the world,
uh-huh.
It may not reach, they may not be able to top that baby off before it's destroyed on the ground. So by destruction, what I mean is, you know, we're not detonating the weapon in place because that would be just as stupid as us allowing a slugfest. So we're destroying the capability to detonate the weapon in situ. Now, of course, the Pakistanis, if we did that, would be very upset.
Well, let me ask you this. Look at India, look at Pakistan. Remember the United States and the Soviet Union in the standoff, the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think it was pretty clear that if the Russians, Soviets, excuse me, so long ago had thought we were defenseless, they would have erased this country in a New York second. They would have launched on this country, and that would have been that. I mean, if they knew we could not fight back with nuclear weapons. So what makes you think that India wouldn't take advantage immediately of the situation, take not only Kashmir, but perhaps take over Pakistan as well?
That could very well happen, Art.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Could very well happen. But it's whatever happens, that it happens. What cannot happen is a nuclear slugfest, and it's not going to happen.
And let's see, how can I ask you about this? You have great confidence in your scenario?
Not great confidence, but...
Not great.
But I...
It could work out.
Let's put it this way. I'm pretty cocksure of myself, but I don't have great confidence. How's that?
Leaves me worried. I mean, I look at what's going on over there right now and...
Art, we're not going to allow it. It can't happen. That's just too damaging to the world, to the planet. And we now have, the situation's very different than the Cuban crisis. Very different indeed. We now have the wherewithal, you know, to stop that from happening, to see it beginning to happen, and to stop it in place. You know that we can see it happening. You know that we can see a missile being readied.
Sure.
The signals intelligence, all the intelligence systems.
Well, let me ask you this, Ed. What do you think would drive the State Department and other countries, allies of ours, like Great Britain, to tell their citizens to get out? I mean, how far does it go to get to that point?
As far as it's gone now. I think our government's pretty sure that the level of insanity there, especially with the Pakistanis, is enough that the unthinkable may just happen.
Oh.
Now remember, the hypothesis that I'm giving you is secret. this is a secret hypothesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
This plan is not going to be promulgated publicly because we would hope that those two countries could iron out their difficulties in a non-nuclear way, hopefully in a political way,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, of course.
So the scenario I'm suggesting to you would be very secret. We would do it, and it would just happen. And Pakistan would lose all its queen off the chessboard in one fell swoop. But that's a better scenario, that's a better situation. And in fact, I'm submitting to you that that is probably going to be what would happen if they start arming and fueling those missiles. That's a whole lot better situation than any other situation, including Kashmir being overrun.
You know, I look at the news, and you hear troops are withdrawing, then you hear another country's troops are advancing, and I don't really trust any of the news I'm getting out of there right now. I don't have a clue. But certainly when they step in and say, time for Americans to leave, I know for sure when they step in and say, here's aircraft, Americans are ordered to leave, then flag's about to go up.
There's going to be a conventional war. If we strike a deal with India like that, you bet it's going to be a conventional war, because the Pakistanis, if they're getting ready, if they're poised to launch, let's just say, you know, extending our logic here, our insane logic, if the Pakistanis are indeed going to launch and we take the queen off the chessboard, they'll be as angry as pismires then, and they're still going to attack.
There'll still be a war. Yeah. Do you think it's possible that they could have a conventional war that wouldn't go nuclear? Now they're what, three wars or so deep now. If they have another war now, both sides have nuclear weapons. Could they have a war, and on both sides they'd restrain from using nuclear weapons? It doesn't seem likely, does it?
It doesn't seem likely, but who knows? Yes, it's possible, but we would still be watching. We would still be watching, especially the Pakistanis. We would, in a moment, in fact, we wouldn't wait. We would not wait under those circumstances. We would probably preempt the Pakistanis. That's my guess. We have to choose sides, and the Indians are the winners. They're going to be.
But we would preempt using the kind of technology you just talked about.
We would use the technology. If there was a conventional war, a full-blown conventional war, then probably the odds that the Pakistanis would revert, because eventually they would start to lose. They have good troops, but not as many as India. They would start to lose a war, and then you know what would happen. And so we would stop that. The scenario that I just posed to you would probably go down pretty quickly, and we would preempt the use of those. We would allow them. Every time they fueled a rocket, or every time they prepared one for launch, we'd take it out.
Could you say that you have enough personal knowledge of this technology being in place to be comfortable that this ain't going to happen?
If I wasn't comfortable, I wouldn't say this. And I wouldn't be playing and monkeying with the minds of 20 million of your listeners or however many you have out there. That's not fair. Okay. But, yeah, I'm pretty comfortable, Art. Now, does that mean that there might be one or two that gets through? Possibly. It could possibly happen. Yes. You can still hide a weapon. But the Pakistanis, are not as sophisticated as the Russians were and are today in hiding weapons.
Uh-huh. I wonder, they demonstrated a missile launch the other day, and it was saber-rattling of a sort, but it seemed a very effective test. I wonder how many of those type delivery missiles they've got ready.
Well, that would be classified, but they would be quite easy to destroy in place. It would just take a few minutes, Art. You know that. America could do that without any problem whatsoever. And it would.
And it would.
If they were nuclear-tipped, it would.
Would it? What would America do politically, do you think, with India at that moment? In other words, at the moment, we were destroying Pakistan's nuclear capability. What would we diplomatically be saying to India?
We'd strike a deal with the Indians, and that deal would be supported begrudgingly perhaps by many, but that deal would be supported by many other countries, the deal that we struck, because there are many countries that would, you know, are biting their
nails. What kind of deal? I mean, did you imagine?
We just simply say, you're the winner. You are now the superpower in South Asia. You have the you won by default. Just don't use the weapons. Don't use your nuclear weapons. And in return, we will incapacitate and neutralize Pakistan's nuclear delivery capability.
And all of this, you assert, would be done quietly, privately, behind the scenes.
Until it happens. And then we, of course, the world would know what happened.
Would Pakistan, would we tell the world, or would Pakistan tell the world?
It would be, everybody would know. President Bush, of course, if this scenario played out, would tell the rest of the world what he did.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he'd be a hero. The U.S. would be a hero.
Well,
Pakistanis would be mad as hell, but...
There might be some other people mad as hell, too. Russia might be mad as hell.
Not necessarily.
Because they would see their strategic pile of nuclear weapons as total rubble. And the Chinese, of course, they might go totally berserk because they think right now they're a big nuclear power. If we go and we prove that we can destroy everything sitting there on the pad or just as it leaves the pad or whatever, then we've got some other situations.
It's a big risk because if we, these weapons like this, if they exist, the kinds of weapons I'm talking about, let's say Aurora,
that's good, yeah.
Okay. If they exist now we tip our hand, we show our hand.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
And now everybody knows that what we have, and so they can prepare defenses against it. So it's a, economically, in terms of defense monies, it's a very difficult decision to make. But
sure.
The upside is no
nuclear war.
No nuclear war. Yeah.
You don't happen to know, Ed? Do you? I've been asking everybody if all of the nuclear weapons, supposing your scenario didn't play out, and all the worst happened, and all these nuclear weapons were exchanged. How much dirty radiation would get into the jet stream, and how serious would it be? What would be delivered here in North America? How potentially serious it could be for us? Selfish question, I know, but a lot of Americans would like to know.
I don't have that kind of calculation. I don't know. That's the kind of stuff that Carl Sagan used to do, and others like him. And I don't have but I know it would be extremely damaging to Asia and to East Asia. Extremely damaging because the plume from all that radiation, even if a couple of large weapons were detonated, would do a lot of damage. I don't think if we had two or three weapons that were detonated that we'd really suffer any real long-term heavy consequences in North America.
Right.
But they certainly wouldn't South Asia.
Well, I hear numbers ranging up to 150 on one side and quite a lower number on the Pakistani side.
No.
But
no.
That's still a lot of weapons.
No, there's not that many weapons there. No. No, there's not that many weapons there.
All right. Well, I'm sure that you've given a lot of comfort to some people out there tonight, anyway, in this situation.
Well, you should know that a lot of the tax dollars that go to these secret programs, I mean, we in the military have looked at these scenarios as that just, you know, have lost a lot of sleep as in defending the country like, you know, you and I used to do. You lose a lot of sleep, you know, on looking ahead at scenarios like this, knowing that they're possible. And now there may be the wherewithal to take care of it. Now, nuclear terrorism is a far more difficult problem.
And one we'll talk about that too. In the meantime, actually some pretty comforting words, if you buy them, Major Ed Daines. So we can take those suckers out right on the pad. Tip our hand, but we could do it. Well, I guess that would be the time if you were going to do it, huh? I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Back now to Major Ed Dames. Major Dames, welcome back.
Thank you.
By the way, in the first hour, I don't know whether you've listened to the program, you know, over the last week or two or whatever, but I've had Kreskin on, the amazing Kreskin, and he's made an interesting prediction that there'll be the biggest UFO sighting in this century in the Nevada desert, of course, right above my head, no doubt. The biggest UFO sighting in the century, it will be seen by hundreds, he says, and now he's going to pin down to the date and the time. Do you think this is a foolish thing to attempt to predict, or do you think psychically it's possible?
Well, I think anything is possible. I think it's foolish. Yes, I think it's foolish.
Uh-huh.
But who am I to say?
And he put up $50,000 if he's wrong.
Well, now that's okay, and yeah, interesting.
It's very interesting, yes.
Mm.
All right, listen.
But I have been listening to your program, and I've enjoyed your shows lately quite a bit, and you both your guests and your callers, very interesting shows.
Uh-huh. Thank you. On a past program, I threw out to you another assignment. One of the strangest things, one of the more inexplicable things in the entire world, other than the pyramids, you know, at Giza, I've been in them. They're inexplicable. Even the experts in Egypt get to a point where they throw up their hands and they say, we don't have the slightest idea how they were built. In Florida, there's this coral castle. And this man who built this coral castle and seemingly did the absolute impossible and moved these giant rocks, tons and tons of giant rocks in building this coral castle, and then at one point had to move the whole damn thing and virtually did it overnight. I mean, he did things that just... And then we have this picture, Ed, of inside the coral castle, what appears to be some sort of mechanical... magnetic, it almost looks like, I don't know, some sort of, something out of a movie, some sort of mechanical device that's got magnetism or even electromagnetism involved and a hand crank. It's a doggone thing. But I mean, all of this is history. This man really did do this, and I sort of assigned you to see what you can find out about the construction of the Coral Castle, and I'd really, really love to hear what you've got to say on the subject.
Well, we cracked it, Art.
You cracked it.
We did. But it's kind of sad in a way, don't you think? When the mystery was so much fun. It's so exciting to wonder how this guy did. I mean, what could it be? Something supernatural or something? Did he discover a lost science or whatever?
The guy was a small man.
Yeah, he was. But it's kind of sad in a way when you find out, you know, when you find the answer and it's like, in retrospect, oh, of course. But it takes all of, you know, all the glamour is gone now.
Well, I don't care. I want the answer anyway.
Okay, I'll give it to you. The guy was an absolute genius. He was ingenious. He built all those gearboxes and things like that that you're seeing. The pictures that you have,
yes,
they're electric pumps. He used water as counterweights. He used hydraulics and he used water. So when the block and tackle that he had and all of their gearboxes and electric pumps,
yes,
he pumped water up into holding tanks to use as counterweights until he could lift, no matter how heavy a block was, until he had enough water just to move this thing. Then he positioned it, locked it, and braked it using fulcrums and locking devices to align and position it. And then he just let the water out slowly till it was in place that he wanted, and then he released, and then he let the rest of the water go.
Huh.
So those are electric pumps that you see in gearboxes.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
How do you think that relates to the way the possibility of the way the pyramids were constructed?
Well, it's an excellent question, Art, because when I saw, in retrospect, and you look at these. You say, of course, that's how he could do it. That's one way he could do it. But then the question is, the one you just raised, where did he get the idea to do this?
Right.
And that is what led me to suspect that maybe, you know, the guy is actually a remote viewer himself, some type of a, he was psychic in some way. And
took a look at how the pyramids were built, yes.
That, I mean, I'm just hypothesizing again. And thinking that maybe he locked on to a construction method somewhere in the distant past, whether it was in Egypt or someplace else, where this method was actually used.
Do you think, Ed, the Egyptians would have had the technology or any sort of technological level that would have let them pump that kind of water for that purpose?
Well, they could have used sand, too, you know. Sand would have worked. It would have been a lot more, it would have been more difficult, but sand could have worked just as easily as water, especially if you're loading it with a bunch of hired help or slaves.
Yeah.
But Lee Scallon used electric water pumps and he used hydraulics to do it, and he used water as counterweights. That's why you see, in some of the old pictures, you see these cranes and everything. He had cranes, but nobody saw how he used them.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. And in retrospect, it says, uh-huh, he could have done it, and he realized what all that stuff is. So, but, and you know...
Shouldn't there have been the discovery of very large water tanks? Or...
Yeah, yes, I think that some... I think that that all that stuff is gone. You know, you got a lot of rusted and parts like that. If you would have had things like that, it would have given away. He didn't necessarily have to have large ones, though. He could have had used a series, just like a balance, you know, a scale where you have a series of different weights, calibrated weights.
Out of curiosity, when you did the remote viewing on this, or your team did, I don't know who did it, did you do it personally?
No, this one was cracked by an absolute genius, one of my top guns.
What is it that he depicted, or how specifically did he come up with this answer? Did you end up with a piece of paper showing, a giant crane and a counterbalance? Was that drawn out for you?
Yeah, on projects like this, because professionally I'm so busy with on counterterrorism and missing children projects. I use these projects, these fun projects, for my advanced training students when I teach in my institute in Los Angeles. I use these.
Right.
And so I allow the students to do the work. That allows me to concentrate on the other thing, the aforementioned.
Right.
And this particular student, Brent Miller, the guy's a genius, he sketched the entire situation, the block and tackle, the water, and all that. And where many other students have sketched similar things, he was able to analyze his own work and say, this is how it was done. And then I went back and double-checked it before I did your show, because I don't want to make any more mistakes on the Art Bell show.
Well, that's pretty wild, Ed. That is pretty wild, and, you know...
Oh, it is wild.
And you know, it really does seem possible that's the way it could have been done. I never thought about it.
If you look at those devices and the photographs, a lot of those are electric pumps and gearboxes. And the guy built them himself. He was a mechanical genius. and the method itself was ingenious. And of course, there's no water, so it reminds me of the Sherlock Holmes episode, the icicle murder, where the murder weapon was an icicle.
Yes, and it melted.
Kind of, yeah. So here, this guy could have had bags, canvas bags full of water, you know, and just fill them until you had 4 tons worth of water in there, and the block lifts off the truck, and you just move it into place.
Would that allow, you know, it was said that he moved the Coral Castle very, very, very quickly, and he would not allow the drivers of the trucks to see how he was loading them.
Mm-hmm.
This is how the story goes. So that wouldn't surprise you based on what you're saying right now, would it?
No, because he did have block and tackle.
Uh-huh.
They just don't know how he did it himself without any help. But what he did was pump water into counterbalances and lift the blocks that way and just move them and position them. And just an ingenious set of gearboxes, pulleys, fulcrums, locking devices, block and tackle, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you then think it likely, or at least possible, that the pyramids in Egypt were built in the same manner?
I'm guessing that they very well could have been, except not necessarily water, but sand and or water.
All right, let's jump over a couple of things. I know you've got a lot on the 12th planet, and believe me, people want to hear about that. That's big news. But let's jump for a second to the terrorism. Boy, Ed, India and Pakistan even aside right now, after 9/11, we're getting warnings all the time now. They're going to blow this up, that up, the Statue of Liberty up. They're going to poison us. They're going to release some biological agent, or there are nuclear weapons. It is rumored in place all over America. My God, you can read anything on the internet. But surely we are in this real serious war right now with terrorists, and I would be most interested in what you know about what might be coming to us.
I think I mentioned to you that I'm executive director for the Matrix Intelligence Agency, and it's a think tank, a private consulting group. And
right.
We use Top Gun, world-class remote viewers. In
right.
fact, I have an August employee evaluation coming up, and we will kick out anybody who is not world-class remote viewer in that one. What we look at in MIA is foreign terrorists in the United States. Foreign. No, I say foreign because in terms of the collective unconscious, we don't want to pick up a Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
All right. So on an earlier show, right after 9/11, we set ourselves to looking for foreign terrorists in the United States and what they were after. And we saw that there was one cell that didn't, an Al-Qaeda cell that got away. And they were targeting. They had missed their target. Their target was...
San Onofre.
No, it was Diablo Canyon
Nuclear
Power Plant.
That's right, Diablo.
Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. They missed their target, and they didn't get it. For the last 3.5 months, they have designated a new target, and it's still designated. That target is up on the MIA website, and you'll see warning notice, by the way. You can get to that website via your Keith Rowland has a link up. Yeah, a link up there. And you can get to the website via your site. But
so,
anyway,
so you have the target information on the website?
Yes. Got it right up there.
All right. So
shall we mention it?
Let me go look. Let me see if your site is even.
I'll tell you what. I won't say the name.
Last time we did this, Ed, your site went down.
No, the site's not going to go down anymore. I know who took the site down, and it's not going to go down anymore. We fixed that.
Yeah.
Let me explain what the target is. The target is now you know that all much of our security now.
Wait, hold on, Ed. I've got Mind Dazzle and Remote Viewing 2000.com.
Yeah, if you hit the 2000.com.
Okay.
That'll take you to the remote viewing campus.
Okay, I'm there.
Okay, scroll down the page and click on Matrix Intelligence Agency under my bio.
Let's see. Okay, I'm doing that now, and boom, I'm there.
Okay, you go down to warning notice.
Let's see. I don't have anything that says that. It says Matrix Intelligence Agency, Global Executive Mission Support, blah, 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 knowledge mapping, and then there's a link, direct all inquiries to, and director, and that's all I got, Ed.
Look over to the left. There should be five buttons.
Oh, I'm sorry. Warning notice. There it is on the left.
Yeah, click that on.
Should I click on target, or should I click on the other one?
You can click on either one, but I've actually named it there in red.
Oh, yeah. I see it clearly.
Okay, now I'm not going to say the name on the air, but I'd like to explain this to you, Art. This is a very brilliant idea because the target is, while all of our eyes are now watching the skies, the land, and the sea for those reactors that are around the ocean,
mm-hmm.
or nuclear reactors, a foreign terrorist group is targeting the second largest hydroelectric facility in the United States. They're targeting not the dam, but the power plant itself. And the security at that site is abysmally poor. So as you might guess, I've sent notices to the FBI, to Ridge's office, and to all of the cognizant authorities connected with that particular
story. Well, okay, that brings up a really interesting question, Ed, that I would like answered. You remote view something as a target. You know that there are enemy resources being directed against this target. Does your telling the government or coming on this program and naming that target or telling people where they can get the name in this case, does that almost automatically change the outcome?
I hope so.
Well, yes, but by now, in all your remote viewing experience, you should know whether it is indeed possible to change outcomes or not.
Art, if the event is very large, it appears that it can't be changed.
Well, that's pretty big.
Yeah, it is. And so I honestly don't have the answer in this case. I would very much like to roll the cell up, but the work required to do that is tremendous, and I don't have the resources to do it right now. So I actually use things like the Chandra Levy case and the missing children cases to hone our skills to make sure we get better and better and better, to put together a quick reaction team to support NEST, Nuclear Emergency Search Teams, and Counterterrorism Task Force.
Hold it right there, and we'll readdress this when we get back. I mean, that is a very important point. Can you change the outcome of events that are remote viewed as being probably inevitable? A really interesting question. All right, I think this may be the place where Ed Ames gets to put on his well-worn Prophet of Doom hat. Dr. Doom's Day. Dr. Doom. This program has dealt with something really, really interesting, very controversial. Some call it Nibiru. Some call it Planet X, Nemesis, whatever. And, you know, I always thought it was mythology, frankly. And I don't know, Zach Rye I've had on many times, and he's a fascinating man, and he could well be correct. Or he could be all wet, who knows. But I've always thought of it, frankly, to be honest with you, more as myth than anything else. But then I had some guests on, Mark Hazelwood, and many others, who have talked about Planet X. Now, Planet X, as I keep saying, it was just myth to me until I saw this ABCnews.com article, which said that there is indeed an object out there on the edge of our solar system that they're not quite sure what it is. It could be, they suggest, a burned-out sun or a large planet. They really don't know. It's kind of speculative, but there is solid science suggesting there is something out there. So, you know, obviously that makes the subject of Planet X a very interesting one to tackle. And apparently Ed has tackled the question of Planet X. Is that right, Ed?
Actually, we haven't tackled it, Art. It sort of tackled us over the years.
How so?
Well, about 7 years ago, 6.5 years ago, in training class, in professional training classes, many of my remote viewing students like to look at their own trajectories in time. They take their own lives and try to project forward using techniques, exploring knowledge mining, the collective unconscious, if you will,
mm-hmm.
going into the matrix, is what we call it. Taking a look at their own lives, and based upon that, they could gain a lot of information about the directions they were going or could go. There were options available to them. And these are specialized techniques, though, and we still teach this at the institutional level. But something started to happen about 6 years ago. Individuals who were looking forward in time began to sketch themselves underground rather than a new vocation, or living in a new place, or doing something that they've wanted to do, or whatever. People started searching themselves underground in terms of their future.
You've always said this. You've always said underground.
Right, but this started to happen more and more frequently. Now, as of the last few months, even viewers that, in certain qualified ways in which this never happened before, anybody that looks at their future in any way, shape, or form, any future that they have, and any path into the future,
yes,
is starting to sketch themselves underground. Even young people, old people, everybody. And we wondered what is causing this to happen. Why are people underground? And that's what led us to investigate the, what was going on. And what was going on appears to be what Zachariah Sitchin has called the 10th planet, Nibiru, and that the Sumerians were right. The next passage around is real. The planet is real. The next passage is imminent. And the effects are catastrophic this time around. And 2001 KX76 Astronomical Union's label on one of the objects is a good candidate for this, for being Nibiru.
What do you know the effects would be if this planet or whatever it is comes close to us on a trajectory that brings it close to us relatively to Earth? What would happen?
Two things we know, having investigated this: very high winds, sustained winds for a couple of weeks, extremely high winds, and that's why biblically, the biblical prophets and others have talked about the 3 days of darkness, so much dust and debris in the air from high winds. The winds would be caused because the Earth would wobble or tilt, and that energy would be translated into the atmosphere, and the winds would pick up. Secondarily, and they're finally beginning to understand this, the sun would start, that the Earth would shake, and then we would bake. We would shake and bake because the Earth would pass through a region, what we could call it a contrail or a wake, where our ion shields are down. The Earth's electromagnetic shields are down. So what? Then this is closely concurrent with this event. There are accompanying solar effects. Think of it as a break in the shield, where what would be considered normal conditions on the sun are, for a period of time, as we pass through the wake, when this Nibiru passes back around the sun and we pass through its wake,
yes,
where the solar effects would be catastrophic and we'd have a tremendous amount of heating that we normally would not have.
There have been a lot of astronomers who have observed strange anomalous solar activity with even the passage of comets.
Is that right?
Oh, yes.
I've heard this before, too, so that sort of fits in with what we're getting in terms. If you have a very large thing, planet size, let's say nominally the size of Pluto, that is soaring by Earth and causes it to wobble, that shortly after, several months, when we pass through this wake, we get these kind of effects. Yeah. Now, we also speculate and have over the years that remote viewers who have looked at Mars, why did Mars lose its atmosphere, is that this particular, something like this, either a Nibiru or Nibiru itself, Marduk, Planet X, Nemesis.
Something
of that magnitude actually came so close to the planet Mars that the gravitational pull sucked vacuum cleaner a lot of the atmosphere away from the planet and caused it not to be able to achieve equilibrium.
Well, we now certainly know something we didn't know before. The amount of water on Mars is incredible, enough to cover the planet 1,500 feet deep all the way around. Serious amounts of water. So there was once an atmosphere there that got ripped away by something. You know, there are astronomers who say, well, there was an exploded planet or something, but it would have to be something of that magnitude. Planet X would fit the bill, huh?
I think so, yeah. All of the remote viewers from the beginning of the military team on have always sketched something similar, something that passes by very closely. Now, in the case of the planet of the crossing, as the Sumerians called it, this next passage by is not as close, apparently, as it was with Mars, where the effects were really catastrophic but fatal.
Yeah. But enough to cause winds of what magnitude, would you imagine?
About 300 miles an hour for several days, 200 miles an hour sustained for a week and a half, 2 weeks, where you need to be in a hole, basement, subway tunnel, something else like that.
It would have to be. That would erase 300 miles an hour. for several days. That would erase everything.
Well, it wouldn't be all over the planet, but it would be in great regions of the planet, of course. And
how about the U.S.?
You know, we haven't looked at the specific areas of in terms of survivability and all of that. You have to have fresh water, though, because water would be contaminated, so you need water supplies. Any type of fallout shelter would be great. The government of Switzerland is in good shape, theoretically, because their entire population can fit into to civil defense shelters that are fully stocked. So.
And they would hold up, assuming they were in a reasonable area.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you think that this planet could be back as soon as when?
You know, I'm really sticking my neck out on this, Art.
Well, it's not like your neck hadn't been out before.
No, it hasn't, but I'm really sticking it out this time. Now, if you do the calculations on a theoretical Marduk or Nemesis, it comes in like a bat out of hell, swings around the sun, and it's gone. And it's moving so fast, you're looking at nominally 3 months between the time it enters the orbit of Pluto to the time it gets to the inner planets. So it's not like you don't have warning that this thing's coming. You get some warning, but you need to have a place to go. Anyway, I'm dancing around your question. As early as 2003.
Oh, that is early.
Yeah, it's early. Mm-hmm.
As early as 2003, and there will be, but you're saying 3 months warning? You think the public would be aware 3 months beforehand?
I think so. I think that astronomers worldwide, including amateurs, would see this thing and know that it's inbound. But there would be no way, really, because it's such a surprise until the trajectory is...
That's very interesting, because I asked everybody about that, and they all seemed to indicate they thought there would be some sort of warning, but they didn't know how much.
Yeah, my guess is 3 months from the time it's spotted in the around the orbit of Pluto to the time it gets to the inner planets. And that's moving really fast.
Right? Well, that's going to make some talk radio, Ed. That 3 months.
Yeah, it's going to make a lot. It's dicey. It's dicey because, you know, lots of people are going to start wondering, well, how close is this coming? You know, what are the effects going to be and all that? Well, as remote viewers, we see the effects. The effects
Here's the one good thing. I mean, if something as horrible as this happened, and our atmosphere would survive, and we could survive by being underground,
and we had
3 months a warning, we could dig lots of holes.
Yeah, you could, but remember, it's going to take a while to rebuild infrastructure in a lot of the places that are hit by those kinds of winds. And you've got a Mad Max scenario in a lot of spots, so it's important to have a lot of fresh water.
Boy, there goes my tower.
Yeah. Well, I'd say that even if we're 150 miles an hour, wind, there goes your tower.
Yeah.
So... But this isn't the end of the world scenario. It's just that the next time, the next passage.
Pretty depressing, Ed.
Well, no more depressing than. Let's take a look around.
No, it's more depressing. I mean, you're talking about only survivability below ground. This is so consistent, Ed, with so many. I mean, you have said this of a number of scenarios. The scenarios have changed a little bit. You include the sun in this, but you remember your prediction about the sun.
We didn't understand why this
behaving
solar
that way. Oh,
was happening at the same time. It didn't make any sense, though.
Okay.
It does now.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does now. We understand it now.
So the solar flare is just something you saw, and then you saw something on the ground, and of course you talked about that green stuff we could eat, right? To survive underground?
Well, that's always there for food. We'll always be okay food-wise because chlorella is not susceptible to disease, really, and so that's always there to eat.
Well, you're consistent, Ed. But it's still it's a dire situation. I mean, to imagine that happening to the world, it'd be nice that we don't lose our atmosphere. But gosh, everything else would be virtually gone. 300 mile an hour winds would strip the Earth pretty much clean. I can't see any
I don't think it's the whole Earth, Art. I think it's just belts. The Earth, I don't see how 300-mile winds could be planet-wide. But anyway, this is what happened to Mars in a much worse case when it lost its atmosphere. And the civilization that was there, you know, disappeared, except for some interesting things.
Well, we could probably take a pretty good shot. If we saw an incoming near-Earth asteroid-type deal that was going to hit, we could try and move it. You know, we could launch and put rockets on it, or, you know, explode nukes and try to change its directory, trajectory or whatever. But something the size of a planet or a burned-out sun, we can't do squat about that.
You're right, but the effects of a large asteroid hitting the Earth are far more catastrophic than the passage, the distant passage of a planet-sized object that wobbles the planet, Art.
Wobbling the planet is right up there on the scale of really big things, Ed.
It's there. It's catastrophic, I agree, but not as catastrophic as, let's say a 3-mile...
Well, then you add to it the Earth's magnetic field, you said, collapsing, allowing a blast from the sun, which would be forthcoming, a really big one, and so you've got shake, bake, and sterilize, basically.
Shake and bake. I don't know necessarily about sterilize, but shake and bake, yes.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of Israeli scientists who have a really, really good theory about what killed the dinosaurs, and they don't think it was big rock crashing into the Earth. They think it was... astronomers now know that suns like ours, relatively stable suns, all of a sudden can misbehave. They don't know why it happens, but a passage of a big planetary body would be one really good guess. And the Israeli scientists think that the sun did a big spit toward Earth and killed all the dinosaurs that way, not with a big rock.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, in terms of geological time, that's a whole long time ago, Jurassic, 98 million years ago. But if you look at that city that's off the coast of that alleged city, that's at 2,200 feet off the coast of Cuba, and we talked about that before, and it's really there. There's pyramids on the bottom of the ocean. It's really a city. The only way that could be there is if the Earth tilted. It's the only way.
It's not the only one they're finding under the ocean.
And that civilization is not 98 million years old. That it's probably closer to 5,000 years old.
Huh.
We know that as remote viewers because associated with it are the Nazca lines. The civilization that built that city was associated in many ways with the Nazca lines in Peru.
You also are suggesting, aren't you, that after this catastrophic event, when the dust settles, there will be others here on Earth to help us rebuild?
Yes. Yes.
Just a straight yes. I mean, tell me more.
There's two parts to this. There's something going on Mars. I think Swan, Paul Smith, and I, as remote viewers, know this to be true.
I had Ingo on very recently. And incidentally, Ed, let me try this one out on you. If I were to go to any of the other remote viewers, or all of them, everyone I could get my hands on, and ask them if they'd seen any of this, what do you think they would say?
I don't think that they would say anything about the future, but all of them would say that there's something going on Mars, that there is not only a civilization there, but at least in the case of Paul Smith, because he and I virtually said the same thing, that there are robots operating on Mars.
I'll tell you something interesting, Ed, and we'll get back to the robots on Mars and something below the surface of Mars, which you also said, I believe.
Which Ingo Swann also remote viewed.
Yeah. I found that a lot of other remote viewers are really hesitant to get into the areas that you talk about. And when I ask them about it, it's they don't say that you're not right. They just say they would prefer not to discuss that sort of thing. That's pretty much what they say.
It's pretty dire. But you know why I do it, Art?
Why?
Because it reprioritizes our life. Life is really short, you know.
So well, that it is.
Yeah. So let's get our priorities straight while we're around. And, you know, the doom and gloom stuff, hey, there's only so many ways to die, and we're all going to die. So
yeah, and lately it seems like there's just an endless supply of ways. Ed, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. And when we get back, we will indeed get the lines open, let you talk with Major Ed Dames. On any given night, you just never know what to expect from this man, and tonight is certainly no exception. I'm Art Bell. Okay, once again, here's Major Ed Dames.
Art, if I may, I'd like to announce a new video that is out on, you know, that each month, I and my partners put on remote viewing workshops in Los Angeles. And for those of you who can't attend the workshops or want to sign up for one, there's a video that's produced on day one. It's an eight hours of condensed into 2 hours by an Emmy Award-winning editor. And we just completed that, finished that. It comes with a 50-page booklet. It's the products, that Mind Dazzle, the remote viewing training kit, and our training video and our workshops that we use to generate our income to allow us to do the public service work that we do.
Yeah, that's how you make your money.
That's how we make our money, yes.
Mind Dazzle is exceptionally cool. That I can say. We have Mind Dazzle. And it is... Everything Ed has turned out is awesomely well done, and Mind Dazzle is awesomely well done. I mean, really downtown professional stuff. So that much I can assure everybody of. How much is Mind Dazzle?
Mind Dazzle is $89.95. The new video is $49.95, and it is a superlative project. It's not as classy as the training kit, but it's packed with a whole lot more information. And like I say, it comes with a 50-page booklet,
okay.
A training booklet.
All right, that's a lot, and. So how do they get all or any of this?
They can order on the telephone, or they can go to the website via your website.
Right, we have your link, but I mean on the phone. What's
on the phone, at any time, live operators are at 1-800-441-8547.
1-800, go ahead again.
441-8547.
8547, so that's how you make your money.
That is how we make our money, yes. Additionally, I'm a teacher at the Technical Remote Viewing Institute, but that's a professional-level institute for people who want to pursue remote viewing as a vocation.
How much information is contained on the tape? I mean, what's in there?
There's 8 hours of instruction. It's a very intensive workshop. It's all of the meat of the eight-hour workshop on day one. It's a two-day workshop, and day one is the basic remote viewing skills, and that will allow you to get your feet wet in remote viewing. It's very well done.
All right. So that's a good deal. All right. The 800 number again, folks, is 800-441-8547. That's 1-800-441-8547. 24/7, I think, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, good. I've been debating... For the longest time, myself, Ed, I've been so tempted to give it a try myself, and I can't really explain to you why I haven't. Maybe I don't want to know. I'm a little like that, Ed. I really, most things, you know, I don't want to know. I don't want to know about my future. I don't want to know about the world's future. Isn't that weird? I mean, here I sit doing this show, talking to you, and people like, oh, I want to add to the audience. Somebody just fast-blasted me. Gordon Michael-Skyan has written about the same exact high winds many times. That certainly is true. Gordon Michael-Skyan's coming up June 9th or 10th, I wanted to add to the audience. But he has written, Ed, about those same very high winds that you're talking about.
Well, you know, Art,
part of me wants to think you're out of your mind, and you know, this is not going to happen. A big part of me, actually. I mean, I don't know if I would want to put myself in a position, Ed, where I could personally discern and know the information you just told me to be absolutely true because it came to me.
Yeah, it's easy to go into denial, even for me. for this, you know, and it's an easy way out, put my head in the sand. But as I was going to say, as these events of biblical proportions come around over the horizon, people are going to, especially perceptive people, I teach all kinds of people remote viewing, and the ones who are on the bell curve, kind of naturally psychic, they're going to start having dreams and precognitive ideas about these things coming.
It's already happening.
Yeah, children I talk to, teenagers I talk to, they're starting to tell me, and I had this dream, and it's going to start percolating up as this event. What remote viewing does is it's an over-the-horizon radar, so to speak, metaphorically.
It's already happening, Ed. I'm getting calls and emails. People have a strong sense of impending gigantic event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really all over the place right
word,
now.
Word, but it's not true. Mm-hmm.
Well, and here I sit with my head in the sand. West of Aki's, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have a quick comment and then a question. Major Dames, I wanted to say that I think it's very intelligent and courageous of you to speak of this impending doom. I don't think it's a very good idea for people to keep their head in the sand. And the question I wanted to know was, first let me say, I don't think that you should berate yourself over Chandra Levy, because that means a lot of us are idiots. I saw her underwater, specifically in the Potomac as well. So I don't know what to tell you about that.
It's a fluke as far as we're concerned. We don't like this because it means that we like to think of ourselves as ultra precise, and this is not comfortable for us. That's all. It's non-plussing.
I see. My question is, could an average person such as myself not only train in remote viewing, but could we become employed in this field?
Ah. Well, that is a rather interesting question, Ed. A lot of people would aspire to be employed in this field.
There's the Technical Remote Viewing Institute. If you go to the webpage, my webpage, you can get there by hitting remoteviewing2002.com. That'll get you there fast. You'll see the levels of courses. It takes 120 hours of instruction to become qualified to do this as a vocation. People who complete TRV 300, that course, they go on to put together their own businesses.
But people get to do this for a lot of very different kind of reasons, many of which I fully understand, that are career oriented or life oriented, or, you know, for reasons of their own or whatever.
Oh, I see what you mean, but I think she was referring to vocational.
I'm sure she was. In other words, how many of the remote viewers that go through your school do you end up grabbing up? They're so incredibly good that you grab them up for your team. That must be fairly rare.
No, it's not. All because it's a system. It's just like flight school or anything else. Once you reach a certain level where you're multi-engine or jet qualified, you're hireable. I approach all of my TRV 300 graduates with employment propositions.
Oh, no kidding! Now, do you? That's very interesting. Do you do a lot of work, Ed, for large companies? You know, corporate clients, people who can pay you for your time.
Not anymore. All of us are in training now. We train and we teach. That's primarily how we make a living. And our volunteer work is strictly volunteer.
But
we
isn't
pay,
that turning down an awful lot of money?
Yeah, it is hard. But you know, how much money does a person need? I mean, you know, we all have our individual interests as well. Now, the individual interests are very different. For instance, my primary hobby is the nature of the soul. And others like Aaron Donahue, who is very, very professional. His is analytics and exploring other metaphysical and esoteric things. But so we have hobbies of ours. F.M. Bonzal, the third, is on associative remote viewing and other things.
Yeah, you certainly have taken your remote viewing abilities down a very different road than the rest of the team. And I don't hear the rest of the team criticizing you. They just, you know, there are inevitable questions when I have these other remote viewers on. And, you know, people ask about you, and they don't criticize you. They really just sort of suggest that they don't look at those things.
I think they don't criticize me, Art, because I took this public 10 years ago, and they know that they would not have the audience that they have had I not broken that ground. That's why they don't criticize me.
Okay, first-time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hi.
Hi, this is Don in Huntington Beach.
Yes, Don.
Ed and Art, pleasure to speak with you guys. Art, we have a common friend, Mr. Mark Hazelwood.
Oh, yes.
And I spoke with Mark a couple days ago. He's up in Toronto, and he's got a new love life. He's got a new love in his life, so he's doing good, and he says to say hi.
Good, and thank you.
He's going to hopefully jump on the tour with his dad. Him and Nancy are going to do a European tour this September for about 8 weeks, so I think they're going to have a lot of fun. Ed, are you how you doing?
Fine.
Don't you get tired of getting asked that question?
No.
No. Are you familiar with kinesiology?
Yes.
The protocols of that Dr. David Hawkins has... Do you know David Hawkins, perchance, in Sedona?
No, I don't, but I am familiar with kinesiology.
Yeah, I do not know him, but isn't... I was going to ask you just a couple quick questions, and I'll go, because I know other people are trying to get on here. One, have you guys pinpointed a pretty close date to where you feel the actual passage is going to be?
We can't do it, Don. It's just something... our mind is outside of time, and we don't have any scale, any way of registering the time. We can do it indirectly, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah, you kind of chase it around, right?
There must be something, though, that made you say it could be as early as 2003.
Yes, there is, and it's because there are so many viewers in the last few months who are getting a nothing in terms of any pathway looking at... No matter how you constrain the search term, their unconsciousness is telling them. Unconscious is our best friend. You know, that part of us is our best friend. It says, don't get on that airplane.
Right.
Or
right.
It's all remote viewers are describing themselves underground.
Now, Ed, would I be assuming the correct thing if I said the magnitude of it, too, is something else that's kind of hard to come in on? The magnitude of the passage?
It's not only the magnitude, but the places that will be most affected. It's such a large scale event.
Yeah.
We get lost in it. So it's just big, very big event.
The very protocols of what remote viewing is, it probably is kinesiology, a form of it. Certainly, I think, believe in itself. And you were speaking of dreams just a few minutes ago, Ed. You know, I've had I'm in Huntington Beach, where we sit over 3,000 feet of a water aquifer that's underneath of us.
I teach in El Segundo.
Oh, in El Segundo.
Yeah, okay. Check out the website.
Oh, you're local. So it's not like the ocean's going to come in. There's water already under us, but I've had this repeated dream that across from my apartment, when I'm looking over here, well, I shouldn't say repeated. I've had it, I don't know, three times.
Time is closing in, sir.
I see water under the eaves of the roof, and I realize later on that dream was showing me that there's going to be a tidal bore. I'm about 2 miles from the ocean that's going to pull the ocean in here up 10 to 15 feet higher.
Aye. So water at the eaves of the roofs. Ed, how much of a part do you think that, you know, mass dreams and mass... feelings of impending doom and catastrophic event right there on the horizon. How much weight should be put to all of that?
I don't know that much about it, Art. I know that, you know, a groundbreaking book of late, at least in the last 20 years, was Chet Snow, Mass Dreams of the Future?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Yeah, but I'm just not... that familiar with dreams.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, if there's a collective consciousness and unconsciousness, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
Isn't it possible that it is, it's reaching many human beings at some level, perhaps in their dreams?
Oh, absolutely. The problem is that when it gets trashed. It's like a snowball. The seed, the original seed that the collective unconscious in connection with one's personal mind, personal unconscious, like a snowball that starts at the top of a hill, that original seed is correct. the unconscious will get the right information through into your brain and find a match somewhere in your memory. But by the time you wake up, it gets trashed with all the stuff you have to process and the junk of the day and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And so you don't have the right answer by the time you wake up. Sometimes you do within the first 30 seconds, but it gets it doesn't go in the long-term memory.
But still, if many, 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 many people are experiencing the sense of impending catastrophic occurrence, that would be worth telling.
Correct. And we're not talking about just something like 9/11. What we in America know is very big for us and very meaningful to us. We're talking about something far, far more catastrophic that has an effect on the Earth itself.
I got you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Good morning.
Good morning. Ed, I'd like to get your opinion on this, about this incoming visitor. Do you think that the canary has already pretty much died in the cage? And what I mean by that is, when you look at the sun and the activity on it recently, where it lost 90%, the solar wind went down 90%, we have these unbelievable solar flares. Now we're in a double peak solar maximum. And then on Mars, you had recently the huge storm there. Now the polar ice caps are melting. And I wonder if that relates also to what may be happening underneath. Even SOHO is captured, when it looks at the sun, some strange objects around the sun which are not planets in transit. And then on our Earth, of course, we've got the magnetic fields starting to move in the strange weather. My last question is this. When this planet passes through, if it passes through the Oort cloud on its way into us or near the Oort cloud, and it comes and the 300-mile-an-hour winds come and everything happens, after that comes down, do you think or have you seen a possibility that when these people come from underground, that the trail of debris that this thing may pull in will be almost like a thousand comets hitting our planet, if you follow what I'm saying? Would it drag debris on us after it passes?
Mm-hmm. All right. Ed?
No, I don't think it's going to pull anything with it, because what we're seeing is that nothing hits the ground. Nothing hits the ground. It just gravitational effects pull the planet. That's it. That's all that we have seen. We've really checked this out.
You know, though, Ed, it is interesting, Ed, because I think late science news tells us that relatively small objects like asteroids, a high percentage of the time, have companions that are orbiting them. So what he's suggesting is something that mass, that magnitude, would probably carry with it a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we're just not picking that up, Art. It's clean. It's clean. It's like radiation. When the CIA used to ask us to go and check out a place that they wanted to go into and see how hot it was, and it's the way a remote viewer perceives radiation. You know there's something dangerous there, but you can't put your finger on it. Sort of like a green pressure or whatever. Same thing here. We're not picking up any physical particles, and it's just this big
event.
Gravitational pressure wave. And on the first question, our instruments now are increasingly sophisticated, so we pick up things we've never seen before, too. A good example is this soft X-ray emitter, periodic emitter on Jupiter that you asked us to look at.
Yes. This giant burst of radio frequencies.
Yeah, periodic.
Yeah.
From the North Pole.
Exactly. Just like a beacon, it was said. Listen, Ed, hold on. We'll pick up on that. Just like a beacon from the North Pole there, Jupiter. Scientists are not saying they believe extraterrestrial or anything like that necessarily, but they are suggesting that it's just like a beacon. There is one matter that I absolutely have to clean up. In view of the announcement just made about all the water on Mars, the incredible announcement, the canceling of the news conference by NASA about the water on Mars, saying virtually that the leaks had said it all. I wonder what leaks they're talking about. It's just astounding circumstances with regard to Mars. Ed did say a number of things about Mars, one of which was that there were robots on Mars. Ed, are those, somebody asks, our robots?
No, they're not ours. They belong to someone else. They're actually sentient machines. They're very, first we thought they were actual life forms, but they're not. They're machines. They were placed there. They're doing something.
They were placed there by life forms.
Yes. It's like they're in a maintenance role, and they're really there. They're on the surface and below the surface. We know a lot about the connection with certain UFO events here on Earth. I'd like to also mention one thing and re-mention it, because in shows years ago, on your show years ago, I mentioned this before. There, if you look at the cover or the centerpiece of Richard Hoagland's book, The Monuments of Mars.
Yes.
In about 1989, I started to, along with Dr. Hal Puthoff, who had assigned some Martian targets to the military team as practice. And, you know, I was the training and operations officer, so I got to call the shots. And what we were interviewed?
Right.
Well, one of the things, and if you look at the Cydonia crater region Richard has, there is, off to the right of his sketch, there's a broken crater all the way to the end to the right. And in that crater is what appears to be a tiny pyramid perched on the edge of the crater. And I am telling you that that is an artificial structure. I don't know about the rest of the structures in Cydonia crater, but that particular pyramid, that skinny, sharp pyramid, is not a natural feature. It is definitely artificial. I use the term man-made loosely. And it has underground components as well.
If somehow we survive long enough without X coming by and mixing us up.
Well, the Bible says one-third of the people, one-third mm-hmm. of the fishes in the sea, and one-third of the plants on land, that leads two-thirds of us are.
Yes, but I'm trying to say, if somehow we survive long enough, and the 2003 earliest prediction is incorrect,
hopefully.
And we have long enough to have a manned mission to Mars, when we get there, we're gonna really have some big surprises if what you say is true.
There'll be a lot of archaeological expeditions, and I want to point one other thing out too, that the military team in working targets like this noticed in terms of the future, exploring the future. And on another show, we'll talk about, we can dedicate an hour to actually the operations that the military team had on looking at Mars. Problems that we had in terms of trying to understand remote viewing as well as trying to digest the data. There were a lot of Asian-looking people out there in deep space. And lots of Asians and Russians. And very few Americans, and that's disturbing.
That's interesting.
It's very disturbing.
That is disturbing and interesting.
If you're an American, it's very disturbing.
Yeah, you know, first time on our line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
How are you doing? I'm from Fall River, Mass. Hey,
yep.
Martin, Ed.
Fine.
I was wondering if you could answer a question about Planet X, Ed. You mentioned that after the passage of the planet that we have visitors that would help us clean up. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and if that has... You know, I noticed that you mentioned a lot about biblical meanings to all stuff, and I was wondering if it had anything to do with the Antichrist, and this, what does this planet signify in the Book of Revelations?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Ed?
Yeah, we don't know how long and time after this, the stuff to the fan, this other race is here, but they are here, and they are humanoid. They look like us, and it's almost like they, I don't want to spike it too much, but they're very much like us, like humans, and they're not alien. So I think they're humans. But the event is described by several of the biblical prophets who think the same event that, for instance, Isaiah calls, Isaiah the prophet calls the chastisement.
Yes.
We think it refers to this. Yeah, the seventh seal, the seventh sun, the seventh thunder in some Native American Indian religion.
That's right.
End of the fourth world of the Hopis, that kind of thing.
That's right.
One of my last students pointed out to me that the seventh thunder, the tribe that described it, they described at the end of the world being underground, and they do not dig. This is a tribe that does not dig. So, very interesting.
That is, yeah, very interesting. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Mr. Dames, earlier you spoke of these craft that you think could go Mach 20 plus mile per hour.
Mm-hmm. A hypothetical scenario, uh-huh.
Okay.
How about diamond-coated surfaces, carbonized surfaces.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, these bases on the moon and on Mars, if we have that technology, and you know that we have technology at least 50 years ahead of what we know of, why is it not feasible to think that these are not ours? I have a video footage from a UFO investigator in Reno that it looks pretty good. Some old German.
Well, we all do, sir. My website is absolutely full of the same kind of footage. The question, bottom line question is, Ed, these UFOs, why is it not, he said, feasible to imagine or to know they are not ours, or they are ours?
Many of those are ours. The Aurora program itself, you've got something moving that fast. Let's say, Mach 15, Mach 20, diamond-coated surfaces, carbon run them so it doesn't burn up. You can't communicate with it normally because it has a plasma around it, so that's out. So the point is you can't put a man in there either because they can't take the Gs. So it's a robot. It's pre-programmed and all of that. And you have to get around. You have to go up. Further out into the future to have a technology where you can put people in a vehicle and not have them die from G-forces.
Turn to jelly.
Yeah.
Yeah. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
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 Hello, Major Art Bell. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of quick questions, and I'll get off the air. Number one, something that personally that happened to me. Since I was about 13, I'm 30 now, until I was about 25, I was able to put myself asleep by viewing as if I was flying over grids or surfaces and pinpointing a hole, diving into it, and then I would level out again. And the further I would go, the further into sleep I would get. I don't do this anymore because the last time that I did it, out of nowhere, I heard a metallic-sounding voice, and a caller about a year and a half ago described the same thing, and I called in, and I didn't get on. But it reminded me of my experience, and I'm wondering if the Major has any comments on, in a raw sense, if this has anything to do with remote viewing in a kind of a naive way, or what I probably encountered. The voice said to me, "Who are you?" And it was very ominous and enough to kind of scare me straight. And I'm wondering if in your travels, remote viewing, if you've ever encountered anything that has come into your path, whether it be an entity or another remote viewer.
Okay, that very much like that confronted you, obviously was communicating directly to you, Ed.
Not like that. But we know that angels can shunt. Angels are very real, and they can shunt you away from things. For instance, if you attempt to get into someone's mind to hurt them or to make a Manchurian candidate out of them or something like that, a guardian angel shunts you off. You would lose the target. So you can't do that. This doesn't seem to be allowed.
Okay. What are the Rockies? You're on the air with Major Eddie.
Hello. Hi, this is Peter Phoenix.
Hey, Peter.
I had a question on Planet X for Major Dames, but first I wanted a clarification on a point he made earlier. If I heard correctly, his student have to complete 120 hours of coursework before being qualified to remote view professionally. That's is that 120 credit hours a la college or actual time length?
Yeah, it's 120 credit hours, institutional, in-classroom hours.
And what would that translate to approximately time-wise?
Go to my website, TRV Institute website, and all that data is there. Let's see.
Okay, great. According to Stitchin's work, during a previous passage of Planet X, Earth was visited by its inhabitants who used Earthlings as slave labor to mine gold. Mm-hmm. Has your findings indicated if X is still inhabited by intelligent life forms?
Well, first of all, it's different. No, I haven't spent that much time with Nibiru itself. It does appear to be just a barren planet. It's hard for me to believe that people jump ship each time they do that. And ordinarily, I would say this is bunk except for one thing. Unfortunately, I did not want to say it on any of our Bell shows. You know these instances in the past where whole train loads of people disappear?
Right.
You've heard about these?
Yes.
Okay. Well, guess what? When we track them down, they actually are underground, as in a catatonic state as slave laborers. Now, I never wanted to say that on the air, ever. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to say it because that comes close to what Sitchin was talking about. Yes, we have run into it. And the way we run into it, we've seen Romans, we've seen German soldiers, we've seen South American Indians, all underground, catatonic state, slave labor. A craft will come in underground, a big bell or a loud noise, these people will stand up, go unload the craft, that kind of stuff.
What are they unloading?
It's some type of pods with supplies. Look like supplies, but you know, this is not something you go and tell the National Security Council or anybody else. If you have TRV products or remote viewing products to sell, you don't tell the public this kind of stuff normally, because you know you want to make a living and
right. You
want to keep this stuff to yourself.
Have you looked into what the purpose of their master is? We infer as far as what they're doing with slaves and why they're doing
it. Yes, a little bit. It looks like it might be a self-help program where there's these kind of folks there. Think of them as an assistance group, like a Galactic Red Cross that are here to like stockpile, for instance, something that is used in an emergency for Earthlings, and instead of using robots. For some reason, they use these humans that ordinarily would, just before they were killed, they would be scarfed up and used as slave laborers. That's as close as I could come to. I mean,
amazing. Thank you. You both have a good evening.
Yeah,
you too. Sounds like a great future. I would think that Americans would make truly lousy slaves.
Art, before we leave tonight, I did want to point something out. I hope that picture on your website in your gallery is a hoax. I hope to God it is, because it is one of them.
Which picture?
That half thing that Amani Ibrahim sent you.
Oh, the half human, half alligator?
Whatever it is.
Okay, well, you know, I'm getting messages by Fast Blast that thing is actually in a museum, Ed.
That's a strange thing, Art. That's a strange darn thing.
Tell me about it. That's why I put the photograph up there.
Yeah,
but I am told this thing actually is from a museum. So it's something, yes, you might want to take a look-see. And either tell us it's some kind of hoax, but it does physically exist, Ed.
Yeah, I'm going to take a look at that.
Either it's a hoax or things were not as we thought they were. I don't know. It's weird. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Major Ed Dames. Hello.
Yes, this is Daniel in Omaha, Nebraska with Stratcom.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to lend some credibility to what he was saying about India and Pakistan, being a former intelligence analyst, and the fact that the two countries have probably been warned already by the United States to not be using nuclear weapons, and probably the United States would step in and stop it anyway.
That would be the trip that we're not supposed to attach too much importance to?
Well, we did this one before when Nixon was president. The Chinese were in a dire situation when the Soviet Union decided on a preemptive thermonuclear strike against their whole country.
I remember that, actually.
Many people have paid any attention to it, but Nixon stopped it.
You verify that's true, Ed?
Yes, the Russians they saw the potential of China, the future of China, not in terms of remote viewing, but just in terms of technology, and that a point was going to be reached where they wouldn't have enough bullets.
Yeah, the generals there were getting very worried. In fact, Moscow didn't know about it.
Yeah, it was a dicey, very dicey situation. In fact, that's one of the reasons I was this country's biological warfare case officer for the Army. And that's one of the reasons why we could not convince the Russians when we talked to them behind closed doors. Why don't you stop researching biological weapons? They said, because we don't have enough bullets to stop, because you would not let us preempt the Chinese when we could have taken out all their nukes. Now we don't have enough bullets to stop them coming across a 7,000-mile border. We have to keep these weapons of mass destruction.
So, caller, you know from personal knowledge that Ed's scenario is sound?
Yes. And as a kind of a follow-up, I don't know if anybody is aware of it, we had it all published here at the in Omaha in one of the newspapers that on 9/11, the United States Air Force was sitting there doing an exercise to load all nuclear weapons on the planes and gas them up. And they were all sitting on the runways when they heard about the two towers going down. That's a very, as well as all of the nuclear weapons on the missiles. We were going through a regular exercise here, and the whole world could have been in a real big tangle if somebody had decided to use all that stuff.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Actually, this may be one of the few times, Ed, that you've been able to come on my show, at least at the beginning of the show, and give what amount to comforting words to people.
It's probably be the last time, but I'm glad I could accommodate your listeners at least for once.
Yeah, that's very nice. And yes, I would like to know what that creature is that I've got a picture of on the website. I'd very much like to know. And if you want another project, there are various MPEG videos of really, really, really good UFO sightings, and I'd sure love to know what they are. So if you want to fool around with all of that a little bit, I'd actually very much appreciate it, Ed.
These okay, we'll take a look. Again, these are advanced student sessions, and they're perfect targets for advanced students. So we work normal stuff, but we also work the fun stuff, too.
All right. I want to give you a chance to plug one more time your tapes and whatever else you would like to plug and give out the number here. We're at the end of the program.
Okay, great. We have a monthly remote viewing workshops in Los Angeles, and we have two fine products, a Mindazzle remote viewing training kit, and Emmy Award-winning produced video from our workshop, day one. It's 8 hours of instruction, packed with quality material. And there's a question-and-answer session at the end with me on some of these topics that we discussed in the Art Bell Show. That tape is $49.95 with a 50-page workbook, instruction book, and that's a fraction of the cost of the workshop. And you can get it at 1-800-441-8547.
That's a 24/7 number, so they could call it right now or tomorrow or whatever, right?
Correct, and there are live operators there.
Okay, good. 1-800-441-8547. Well, as always, Ed, boy, it's always something to have you on with me, and we'll do it again very soon. You're always a bundle of surprises. What I expect is never what I get. And that's great.
Stay well, Art, so we can do it again.
Thank you, Ed, and good night. All right, that's Major Ed Dames, folks. Boy, I'll tell you, of all the things that I thought we would cover tonight and the way the program began, I just never in 1 million years would have guessed that's what it would have been, but that's what it is. That's why I like it sort of on the fly. And just take it as it comes, kind of talk radio. It sure is fun. From the high desert, having fun, I'm Art Bell. Good night.